So to reflect a little bit more upon this quality of joyfulness, and to really think of joyfulness not as a state, but as a capacity that we all have for joyfulness. Something not to be neglected. So before we broke, I was speaking about this dimension of joyfulness, which is often described as sensual or worldly joyfulness, and this is not a way of somehow denigrating this, because this is often where we really begin to have confidence in our capacity for joyfulness. Our path is actually not made more noble by the uninterrupted preoccupation with dukkha. And developing that capacity for joyfulness often calls upon many of the things that we've spoken of in terms of mindfulness, in terms of metta, in terms of stillness, in terms of empathy, many of the skills that we develop in the path. The Buddha speaks about joyfulness having many origins. And one of the origins that he speaks about is actually joyfulness that is rooted in ethics or integrity. He speaks about tasting the joy of blamelessness. Tasting the joy of blamelessness. You know, when our thoughts, words, and acts are rooted in ethics and integrity and metta, how they leave no residue in the mind. No residues of regret, no residues of shame, no residues of guilt, how it actually enables and engenders relationships of trust and confidence, how it leaves the mind clear, experiencing the joy of blamelessness and really realizing it is that ethical foundation that really provides the inner environment in which the seeds of joyfulness can really be planted. Now, at times, joyfulness is also spoken about as rapture or some of the really quite blissful states associated with deep meditative development, particularly in samadhi practices. And although the Buddha says these are not ends in themselves, that they're not paths of liberation in themselves, I think one of the reasons why meditative development is extolled so highly in this teaching is that this is often the first time that people glimpse inwardly generated joyfulness and happiness. And that can be quite radically transforming. You know, the nature of a very deeply collected mind is joyful. You know, the nature of a deeply collected mind that has really stepped out of proliferation and papancha, its tone is joyful. You know, one of the synonyms for nibbana or awakening is nipapancha. It means the end of proliferation, the end of obsession, the end of rumination. The taste of inner stillness, the taste of inner collectedness, is that of joyfulness. Which is why the Buddha so praises to discover this capacity for inwardly generated well-being and happiness, because this really changes our relationship to the world of sense impressions. You know, it puts an end to that almost kind of seemingly endless pursuit of more and more pleasant sensations in order to be happy. So the Buddha says, you know, sit on your cushion, go on your walking path, cultivate this collectedness, cultivate this gatheredness of heart and mind where you step out of these cycles of distress creation and really have a taste of that inwardly generated happiness where it feels like nothing is missing. Nothing is missing. There is nothing to improve upon this. This takes effort, takes time, takes commitment. And as I say, we're constantly, we should think of ourselves being on a pathway of learning more and more to make room for joy. And that means stilling. You know, I'm so touched by the Chinese calligraphy symbol for busyness, which translates as heart killing. You know, I think none of us have lives that are, you know, completely free of demands and responsibilities and needs. Of course we do. But please, please take note of how much busyness is a state of mind and how much it is a state of mind that really precludes joyfulness. So this is actually what we're learning to calm, what we're learning to collect in meditative development, to actually to calm the agitation of all of that busyness. It doesn't mean it make us incapable of meeting the demands and responsibilities and needs of our life, but it really does make us aware that this mind state of busyness is optional. It's quite optional. I think sometimes this cultivation of stillness and making room for joy is really, this is such a practice for being in life. You know, how to stop, how to pause, how to listen wholeheartedly, how to see wholeheartedly, how to touch wholeheartedly. And you'll probably notice that that capacity is not very compatible with the mind state of busyness. You know, where we're always leaning forward or anticipating or leaning forward into the next moment, the next event, the next thing. But this is a skill to cultivate, you know, just how to pause, how to stop, how to see. There's a wonderful statement in a haiku. It says, if you keep the green bough alive of spring alive in your heart, the singing bird will come. You know, this is something that is possible for us. And, you know, this so weaves into the Buddha's teaching on our capacity to develop wise or skillful attentiveness. You know, ayanaso manasakara, you know, this unwise or unskillful attentiveness, this, we can spend too much time there, you know, grasping at the sense impressions and our associations with them and the stories. And we can learn to spend more time, actually, with skillful attentiveness, to actually bring that wholeheartedness to our sense doors without adding our personal story to it all of what I like and what I dislike. One of the dimensions of joyfulness that the Buddha speaks about is the joy of gratitude, the joy of gratefulness. And this is, again, really expanding the field of our concern. Martin Luther King Jr., I think, put this so beautifully when he says, whether we realize it or not, each of us lives eternally in the red. We are everlasting debtors to known and unknown women and men. When we arise in the morning, go into the bathroom and reach for a sponge provided for us by a Pacific Islander, we reach for soap created for us by a European. Then at the table, we drink coffee provided for us by a South American, or tea by a Chinese, or cocoa by a West African. Before we leave the house, we are already beholden to more than half of the world. This is where we widen the field of our concern and the field of our awareness. Instead of living in these rather this image of these rather shrunken selves, you know, it's kind of like shrunken me, like moving through the world where it really is all about me, and learning to expand that field of awareness, you know, cultivating that sense of gratitude. Joyfulness is certainly not a denial of the deep feeling we may have of there not being enough or not enough acceptance, and yet here we are in the only life we can live. And again, remember this word, vihara, Brahma vihara. Where are we going to make our home? Where are we going to make our home moment to moment? Do we make it in resentment or in gratitude? These are the choices offered to us by this pathway. In my understanding, a cultivation of joyfulness as an insight practice has a powerful effect in uprooting the impulses of craving and aversion. As a practice of liberation, uprooting the impulses of craving and aversion. If you think about in a day, when do the impulses of craving arise? Are they in the moments when you feel the most deeply contented, most deeply easeful? Or does craving arise in the moments when you feel most discontented, that something is lacking? Something is lacking. It is really, I think, important to understand that craving and aversion rest entirely upon the belief that someone or something holds the implicit power to make me happy or unhappy. If I don't have that belief, there is no ground for craving or aversion to operate. It's really that simple. Imagine if someone came to you and looked you in the eye and said, make me happy. How would you feel? How would you feel? Would you say, sure, I'll make you happy? Or would you actually acknowledge, I actually don't have the power to make you happy? And yet how often we can go out of our door in the morning and look at the world and say, make me happy. Almost promoting that belief that, you know, the power to make us unhappy or happy is implicit in objects and events and people. Without that belief, craving and aversion have no operational base. This is the end of craving. This is the end of aversion. It doesn't mean there's not discomfort in life or that there's not lovely in life, but that in itself is not about the power to make me happy or unhappy. That actually lies within my understanding or lack of understanding. So the primary work of the cultivation of joyfulness is really to uproot this sense of deficit or lack. And that might be a sense of deficit or lack in our life, you know. I don't have enough, or I don't, you know, I haven't got enough. But it's often far more deeply rooted in an inner sense of deficit and lack, that I am not good enough. Be aware how much of a view of self is built around a sense of insufficiency. I'm not good enough, I'm not perfect enough, I'm not a good enough meditator or partner or parent or colleague, you know, I'm not lovable enough, you know, I'm not valuable enough, I'm not worthy enough, you know. This is a kind of core neurosis of selfing, isn't it? Is lack. Yeah, it's sense of deficit. You know, think about all the activity that's generated around that core belief, you know. If I'm not enough or not worthy enough, boy, I've got a big task in front of me in this life. To become more ideal, to become more perfect, to become more acceptable, to become more worthy, to become more lovable. And then, of course, I have the accompanying friend of that ideal, which is this, you know, endless voice of inner judgment and criticism telling me that I never did enough. It's a really good idea, you know, to actually question some of these core beliefs around selfing and sufficiency and insufficiency, because this, you know, if we want to know the best way to be busy, this is it, you know, and this is heart-killing. You know, I think it is why, you know, the whole teaching of anatta, or the whole teaching of non-self, you know, people look at that with a certain amount of confusion or dread even. This is really good news. This is really, really, really good news. You know? And actually, it's not that it's so alien to you, you know, because I'm quite convinced everybody in this room has got 1,000 moments in a single day of non-selfing. You know, this is not a perpetual backdrop. You know, the view of self is something that arises and passes and arises and passes. There's no constancy to it, you know. It's born of clinging and falls away, with clinging falling away. You know, it's shaped and it falls away. You have 1,000 moments in a single day of non-selfing, but we are so prone to really be impacted by the moments of selfing that we tend to either overlook or dismiss or ignore the moments of non-selfing. They are the moments actually where you feel the greatest sense of joyfulness, of peacefulness, of easefulness. You know, in the simplest things in a day, you know, where you brush your teeth without being the brusher, you know, where you kind of walk without being the walker, you know, where you breathe without being the breather, where you respond without any kind of agendas behind it or, you know, stories behind it, those unhesitating moments of kindness, of compassion. These are moments of non-selfing. It's almost like we have to train ourselves to actually begin to taste the moments of non-selfing as much as we incline ourselves to taste the moments of selfing. So we start to actually, you know, you're not going to work on the insufficient self, you know. You're never, probably never going to be able to appease the deficit self. I don't think that nobody has ever figured out a way to do this. You know, I'm sure you won't be the first. You're never going to find success in appeasing or somehow satisfying this belief of inner deficit or insufficiency. That's quite humbling, it's quite startling, and it's really good news to actually be able to give up all of that agitated activity. To actually really begin to cultivate, you know, this sense of inner joyfulness, inwardly generated joyfulness. This is where we begin to taste really that sense of sufficiency, enough, that nothing is lacking. So it's a good idea to practice, because this is the direction it goes, you know. It's a good idea to train our minds. This is the direction it goes, you know. It doesn't make us into sort of somber, grim Buddhists, you know. It actually moves us in the direction of joyfulness and celebration in all of its forms. And I think, you know, it's really helpful for us to really spot those moments of craving and aversion, to look behind them. What is the mood of the moment? What is the mind state of the moment behind those movements of craving and aversion, you know? Is it contentment? Is it discontent? You know, if it's discontent, is it possible to cultivate more contentment, more appreciation in those moments? But to begin to fast those impulses, because if you fast the impulses of craving and aversion, you're beginning to fast the belief systems around selfing. You're beginning to fast all of that and to cultivate that stillness where the possibility of contentment may be actually really available to us. So being able to pause, to turn towards, and then we see that craving only has one taste, and aversion only has one taste, which is the taste of imprisonment. And we actually see this sense of joyfulness has a taste of freedom. So it's really important that we turn joyfulness actually into a verb and into a cultivation and into a pathway, not some state or that we're going to reach in some future moment. And it's certainly not a reward for having suffered enough. But it is a pathway of cultivation. All of the Brahmaviharas are pathways of cultivation, and I think these are very relational pathways. They don't rely upon you just, you know, going on a year-long retreat or retiring to a cave. It's about how we're present in the world. And it's about really what we are cultivating moment to moment. So the next dimension of joyfulness, which is often really found most strongly within the Brahmaviharas, is about the teaching of altruistic joy. You know, our capacity to celebrate the happiness and well-being of another. However, I think it needs to be bigger than that. I think it's also our capacity to celebrate the happiness and well-being of ourselves. This is what arises when envy and covetousness and resentment fall away. If you notice some of the domains of craving, maybe this is not a distraction actually. If you notice some of the domains of craving, the craving for sensual pleasure, the craving to become the kind of person who has certain kinds of experiences, to become, you know, the successful, lovable person whose children thrive, who has great vacations, fantastic colleagues, endless successes. You know, the craving to become that kind of person, and the craving not to be the kind of person who has other kinds of experiences, the craving not to be the kind of person, who fails, whose children struggle, always rains when they go on vacation, and their cars break down all the time, the craving not to be that kind of person. Now, those cravings, I hope you can see the way that they really disable joyfulness, because they bring in envy, they bring in covetousness, they bring in resentment, they bring in aversion, and all of it is mixed up with these cravings. There is something else that really sabotages joyfulness. And, I've talked some about the view of self that is formed, these personality views that are born of clinging. But there's another way that Buddhist psychology speaks about self in, which is far more sabotaging of joyfulness. And this is mana. It's usually translated as the conceit of self, which is, you said, what does that mean? But it's relational positioning, how I see myself in relationship to you. I see myself as being inferior to you, worse than you. I see myself as being superior to you, better than you. Or I see us all as being kind of the same, swimming in a sea of mediocrity. Now, there's not so much mobility. This is often a much more invisible sense of selfing. It's often inherited. Sometimes it's very often a story that's been told to us by others, or told to us by our society or our culture. That you're the one who's not good enough. You're the one who's inferior, or you're the one who's superior. You're the one who's better than everyone else. But think about how that sabotages our capacity to celebrate the goodness and well-being of another. If I see myself as being inferior to you, I'm probably going to be afraid of you, or I'm going to be defensive, or I'm going to be comparing, or I'm going to be very judgmental. If I see myself as being better than you, I'm probably again going to be very defensive and striving to protect that, and kind of I might pity you, but I won't celebrate you, And if I see us all being the same, kind of immersed in collective delusion, there's not much point in trying anyway. But this is a powerful, powerful aspect of selfing that actually so undermines our capacity to celebrate the loveliness of another. Some of you are familiar with this this blessing that comes from a Sri Lankan text. When the monks and nuns would go on begging rounds, and they would go into villages, they would often bring a blessing for the community with them. And this blessing goes like this: how wonderful you are in your being. I delight that you are here. I take joy in your good fortune. May your happiness continue. I'll repeat that. How wonderful you are in your being. I delight that you are here. I take joy in your good fortune. May your happiness continue. When I first read this, I cringed a bit. I don't know how you hear it, but I cringe about it. This is a bit saccharine, you know, a bit sugary. And then I reconsidered and I thought, well, how would my world be if I greeted everyone who came into it with that blessing? I think, what difference would that make in my world? Instead of people coming into my world and being met with, you know, do I like you, do I dislike you, you know, are we on the same page, you know, what do we have in common, or, you know, you're annoying. Ah, how wonderful you are in your being. I delight that you are here. May your happiness deepen, that may your good fortune, may your good happiness deepen and your good fortune continue. I think, well, that could be something, couldn't it? Not just take the story out. That capacity to celebrate this, about how this is really calming the voice of selfing and othering, you know, which actually arises in relationship to unwholesome patterns. Doesn't arise in relationship to wholesome patterns. You notice how much quieter the voice of selfing becomes, you know, in the light of metta, or in the light of generosity, or in the light of appreciation, or in the light of kindness. So, try turning that blessing upon yourself. This is much harder, isn't it? I mean, I have a young grandchild in my life. You know, this blessing comes so easily. You know, it doesn't matter what he does. You know, he pees on me, throws up on me. You know, whatever he does, it's great. You know, I just delight that you're here. You know. Whatever happens, you know, you just, you know, I delight that you're here. You know? Do I feel the same way about a taxi driver who overcharges me, or, you know, the person who throws their garbage on the street in front of me? You know? Probably not. But try turning this on yourself. I think this is just an absolutely brilliant practice, you know, to get up in the morning, look in the mirror, and say to yourself, I delight that I'm here. You know, I delight that how wonderful I am in my being. You know, I delight that I'm here. May my happiness deepen and my good fortune continue. What would be your response? Okay, just try imagining that. How would that work for you? What would your response be? Good? Yeah, good, good. Your response would be good. Anybody else would have different responses?
Cringe a little bit.
Cringe a bit. Argue perhaps a bit, you know. I'm wonderful in my being except for these bits, you know. Except for those bits.
It would
It would change depending on your mood. Yeah. Yeah. I would encourage you to take this on as a practice. I would encourage you to take this on as a practice because, you know, we can so create the other inwardly. We don't just create the other outwardly. We create the other inwardly in the things that we dislike or are aversive to or things that are imperfect, you know, or an illness or, appearance, you know, mind states we struggle with. We create the other inwardly as well as outwardly on the same basis of aversion, on the same basis of rejection. So it's actually really, because, you know, non-self doesn't mean that we don't function in this world in identities and in navigational selves, you know. And the Buddha was pretty hot on actually cultivating self-respect and dignity. Not rooted in what we've gained or what we possess, but rooted in that sense of genuine sense of appreciation inwardly of our capacities and dignity and ethics. And so, you know, not to imagine that non-self means somehow a homogenization of us all. It's not good. That would be undesirable, you know. But it does allow the lovely to thrive. It does allow the lovely to thrive. So much of this path is actually concerned with cultivating the inner conditions that quite naturally turn down the volume of selfing and othering. It's an almost, I think, an eternal law, you know, that the more I and you, I and other is present, the less joy is present. The less I and you, the greater the sense of joy. So there are so many factors involved in cultivating joyfulness, not just as an emotion or as a state, but as an understanding, withdrawing that sense of projected promise, you know, that the world of people and events implicitly holds the power to make me happy or unhappy. Turning down, you know, taking away the foundations of craving and aversion. The understanding that is involved in really understanding this relational positioning of selfing and how that manifests in our life and how it creates a sense of insufficiency, competitiveness, you know, resentment. Really beginning to understand this relational positioning of selfing. Often, it often feels invisible, but it's actually not very invisible. You know, that mana, this relational positioning of selfing, affects every choice we make in our life. You know, whether we speak or don't speak, you know, whether we allow our want to be invisible or invisible, whether we what we aspire to, what we feel is impossible for us, the degree of dignity we feel inwardly or the lack of that, it influences so much in our life. And beginning to test those edges a little bit, you know, so there's much insight that is needed in order to develop this quality. It is a practice, yeah? Cultivating joyfulness, like all of the Brahmaviharas. I think it's very important that we turn this into a practice, whether it's a practice of how we're using our attention, whether it's a practice of stilling the agitations, stilling the busyness, whether it's a practice of skillful use of attention at the sense doors, so we make room for and are touched by the lovely. I think it's a practice that we might use, as we do with some of the other Brahmaviharas, to actually simply contemplating and staying with some of those intentions and those phrases, you know. Ah, I delight that I'm here. I'm delight that you're here. You know, beginning to actually cultivate the sense of appreciation, this sense also of gratitude. It's very important also, you know, just again to recognize that understandings are not something we have, that understandings are something we practice. Okay, so I think that basically covers more or less what I wanted to say about joyfulness. Any reflections, questions, please? Yes, please.
And I know, you know, not all that long ago, and compassion was a word I didn't even understand much of my life, I think. And there's the other side of the coin, you know, I want the world to make me happy, but I also felt that I had to go out and make the world happy.
Yeah.
And I also had to beat myself up for all the bad things that I had done. And
yeah. Good. Yes, please.
You mentioned early on that the term sympathetic joy is not one of your favorites. That's a term I've often heard to define.
Yeah.
And when you say appreciative joy, it sort of connotes to me the gratitude piece,
yeah.
Not some of the other pieces. So just
tend to rely on, you know, my Pali scholar colleagues. You know, I'm not a Pali expert, but I have a number of colleagues who are really Pali experts. And I learn a lot from them, and I learn a lot about, you know, the nuances of Pali and how it's translated, you know, and sometimes what's accurate and, you know, what's questionable. And I tend to rely on their expertise, you know, and according to them, you know, there's so many words, you know, that we've kind of coined to try and capture a Pali word that, and words that are inadequate. You know, I mean, so sympathetic joy doesn't really fit the spectrum of joyfulness that is spoken about in the Buddhist psychology, because it's never just one kind of joy, you know. And so for me, when I hear them say actually appreciative joy, or sometimes gentle joyfulness is one of the translations that I hear, gentle joyfulness. This feels, you know, far, far broader and more inclusive to me than sympathetic joy. And I don't even know what sympathetic joy means, quite frankly. I don't even know what it means. You know, I have sympathy with your joy. I'm quite sure what it means, you know. And you know, we struggle with language here because most Pali words are very nuanced words, they're very broad spectrum words, you know, like this word sati that we translate as mindfulness. Well, you know, the early translators couldn't find a way of translating sati, you know, so they borrowed mindfulness from the Gospels. You know, because they couldn't find a good word to capture the huge nuances of this word sati. But I think it's why, you know, it's good to probe a little bit beneath some of that vocabulary and actually say, well, you know, what was the Buddha actually really talking about when he talked about joyfulness? And being aware, you know, because Pali is so much a verb language, that joy as a state wouldn't really fit within that kind of way of communicating. Joyfulness or cultivating joyfulness is probably more accurate and more accessible. Mm. Yeah.
Joy in all the forms that you're talking about, it's not fixed, but it's always there when self is absent or alongside. Because I work with four-year-olds, and I see this natural state just, you know, bubbling up alongside their very formed selves. But in the sense that if it's not a fixed state or
It's a capacity. You know, because four-year-olds, three-year-olds, they have moments of fantastic joyfulness. They've been pretty miserable too, and grumpy, you know, my experience anyway. You know, so it's not always there. You know, it's sometimes there, you know. As adults, we tend to veer more into the grumpy rather than the joyfulness, you know, but that's because we simply accumulate more along the way to get in the way of joyfulness, you know. But it's a capacity. You know, it's like the Buddha's teaching in the Brahma Viharas, these are capacity, these are seeds of potentiality within every human mind, not belonging to some and not others. You know, and he talks about, you know, let's take the veils away and kind of liberate those capacities. Yes, please. Well, it's very true. The near enemy of joyfulness is exuberance or kind of euphoria or elation. You know, you really see this in meditative development. You know, because one of the first kind of sort of manifestations of a really collected mind is often in the form of piti, which is a very energetic joyfulness. It can be very blissful. It can also be really hard too. It can be really unpleasant. But it tends to go in the direction of exuberance. And it's often seen to be kind of an obstruction or a distraction because, you know, you get caught in the excitement, you get caught in the euphoria, you know, and it's very energetic and then you collapse. You know, and then you collapse. So, say, in meditative development, a lot of energy and attention is given to calming that exuberance, collecting and calming that exuberance to a much gentler joyfulness, a much gentler happiness. And that's not just in meditative development either, you know, because we see, you know, in our culture, you know, the pursuit of intensity. You know, the addiction to intensity, to the high moments, you know, the peak moments, which, you know, can have that sense of great euphoria or exuberance, often followed by a sense of collapse or, you know, something missing. So it's very true that that kind of intensity or exuberance is actually really seen to be something of a distraction or a diversion or something unhelpful in terms of cultivating a more reliable sense of joyfulness in the, you know, and really being, and I really want to, you know, encourage this phrase in the midst of, you know, because the Buddha describes his qualities as so relational and they're so always in the midst of, you know, so what does that joyfulness mean in the midst of a life that might feel very, you know, very, very fragmented, very, very torn, you know, what does it mean in the midst of, you know, a traffic jam, you know, in the midst of all things, what does it mean to cultivate that sort of much more gentle joyfulness, contentment? Sometimes it may not even have the flavor of joyful, but it might have the flavor of easefulness, you know? So looking at that as very much a spectrum, joyfulness is very much a spectrum word.
Yeah, Daniel.
You mentioned earlier that we're the children of the conditions in our lives. And I learned something during the walking meditation. I've been seeing a lot of, it's also the case that I have a lot of lofty ideals kicking around in my head that I have inherited and that I haven't actually tested in the classroom. Experience. And I felt very inspired by the talk on compassion, and I was walking and I had an encounter with a person outside, and instead of asking him what he needed, I offered something that I thought I would like to do for him in terms of getting him some food. And I saw this mana, this relational positioning of myself as someone who could offer assistance to this person. And I saw this sort of dissonance between this ideal that's in my head and actual praxis of what's called for in the moment. And I also saw this need to let this person know that he was seen. And this was more about me than it was about him.
Yeah.
And I've also learned that the only thing that really helps me in moments like that is having a sense of humor about my own foibles. And this really struck me. And he said, really, I'm really thankful that y'all are letting me have a chance to have a nap, which was also kind of humorous because I'm sure others have approached him and interrupted his nap in an attempt to help him. So I found the walking period very instructive.
Yes, it sounds like it was a very instructive walking period.
Thank you.
And it's great to have the stillness to be instructed. I think it's also really helpful to be just sensitive to the fact that we often live with what feels like quite mixed intentions. You know, in that situation, you know, there probably was the intention, you know, quite wholesome intention to be helpful, you know. And alongside that, there can be a feeling, well, you know, I'm going to feel good about this too. Look at me, you know, look at me being helpful. You know, so I think we have to accept that mixture, you know. I mean, if we waited until we had perfectly pure intentions to do anything wholesome, we could wait for a very long time, you know. And it's very often, it's acknowledging the mixture of intentions and not meaning that stops the wholesome, okay? Because I think it's actually by acting in line with the wholesome and actually putting the prime bulk of your attention there, that is actually what does the effect of beginning to clear out the less than helpful intentions that are entering that moment.
That's what I felt.
Yeah.
I saw it. And he wasn't bothered by it at all. And so I had to realize that too. That
yeah.
Just let that go. You know, let all of that, what I want to go.
Yeah.
Even, it's just something for me to sit with now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, please.
Just had a reflection that, you know, thinking about joyfulness, one of the biggest joys that I've developed in my life is being part of, like, helping in the food bank. And so the other part of that is, you know, for many years you hear the teaching of, like, well, list all the things that you're grateful for. And I just kind of go, but, you know, it's just, but I was having an encounter with one of the members, and I said, well, how are you? And she just had this huge smile, and she says, I woke up. Hey, I woke up. You know, and we just see that happiness. And so I'd like to reflect on that, and that's a succinct joyfulness. I woke up. Oh, that's enough.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to offer that.
Yeah. A friend of mine told me she was looking after her very elderly mother, and her very elderly mother was very grumpy, and that she'd been grumpy her whole life, you know, and was nearing the end of her life, and she said to her mom, you know, like you know, maybe it's time to stop being grumpy all the time, you know, and she said, you know, maybe you could experiment, you know, with this gratitude practice, just at the end of day, you know. Just remember three or four things that you're grateful for on the day. And I was, God, I'm not going to do stuff like that. You know, blah, 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 blah. And after her mother died, she found her gratitude book, where she'd actually been doing that. You know, it's just plant seeds, you know, you never know if there's nothing that you need from them. How they grow. Shall we take a couple minutes to stand up and stretch, and then we'll have a short sit before lunch?